Yes, let's continue. Let's we'll continue with descriptive research and especially then questionnaire service and some challenges we have there. And let me just give another example here, and this is also a correct example. It's from nowadays, and it's quite it may be quite relevant for a lot of the types of questions that we ask today, and who responds to them as well. This question is for real, and this is based on a TV program, and you've seen these things quite a lot. It's a popularized debate program where they tend to pinpoint quite or questions that's very let's say formulated in a very direct way. Let's try to be do this in a proper way. And in this question, in this TV program, to activate the viewers, probably they ask the question. They've become more careful with these things now. In this question, now in this program, the viewers were encouraged to give their response on a question, and the question seems to be quite straightforward. Norway should close its border for refugees from distant countries. Do you agree or do you disagree? And responding to this, you get an amazingly funny result, or I don't know if it's funny, but it's strange, or strange, I don't know. But nearly 90% of the respondents said they agreed to the question. Only 11% said they didn't. And there were actually some 40,000 people who voted here. And this is quite a typical thing you get on these kinds of questions. Is this right? Is this the opinion of Norwegians? Of course not. If we do this in a proper way, and they try to redo this, they ask the identical question. Or a Norwegian company that's professional on this, Opinion Meningsmåling, they tried to do this in the right way. So they did what they usually do. They picked a reasonably large population, in this case 1,600, that was representative of Norwegians. That's similar to what they do in a normal political poll. And the answers there is the other way around. You get some 16% that agrees and 77% that disagrees, and they actually also had a fallback option there, which was I'm not sure. So it's the other way around, and that is the, of course, the let's say the truth here. Why did they get so wrong in the first case, you think? Why were they wrong? Yeah. It can be the people that watches the show. That is one possibility. The viewers are different. But I don't think that's the case. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. probably what you see here is something that's quite common when you do survey studies. Though, and that's usually referred to as response biases. Who is likely to respond to a question? And in this case, it's probably those who are opinionated on these questions. So you get a bias. Who is actually giving you an answer here? And those in this case, those who were willing to give answers were highly biased towards one of the answers here, one of the responses. So you get a highly biased population here. And this is also very, very risky when you, let's say you ask about some kind of a theme, let's say you ask about gaming or something like that, how much, or questions that has to do with how likely you are to be playing video games a lot, something like that, and you put this out on to your Facebook friends, you're a player yourself. Those who are most likely to give you responses are probably not the very representative of the population. Those who wants to give you responses are those who have opinions on this, and maybe those who are interested in gaming and games, and maybe students that's interested in topics like this. And of course, when you try to generalize from the answers you get, these will be very biased towards the responses of that group. So this is always risky when you are going to interpret results from questionnaires. And it is more the case now than it was some 10 years ago, because the response rates you get on internet surveys is extremely low. And the less focused you are when you invite people to take part in a survey, the more biased populations you seem to get out of this. Now, to some ways to get a representative sample. There is a golden standard here when it comes to getting a good representative sample, which is the one that is used quite a lot by the poll institutes, for instance. And that is what they call probability methods. Probability methods means that they do that any individual that's part of a population has somewhat the same chance of being represented into the poll or being invited into the poll. So this is something you can do when you have huge registers of people, for instance. But it's also something you can do on more limited populations, where you, for instance, can just roll a dice or something, or make some kind of a random routine on your computer to pick out names from a list or from a given population. It can be done completely randomly, which is what you do in when you are addressing a huge population. But it can also be done stratified, which is a more somewhat sophisticated way of doing it, where you know something about the population. For instance, you know that there are about 50% girls and 50% men in the population you are addressing. So you make sure that this is also, so you make sure that 50% is drawn from the male population and 50% is drawn from a female population or something like that. That's a simple stratified way of doing it. And you can also do that when you know that you have skewed populations. Let's say you know that among students here, there isn't a 50-50 thing. It's more like a 30-70 thing. Well, that's something then you can represent, even though you can reproduce when you do sampling. And by doing that, you could say that you isolate the effect of of gender in this population, so you don't have to analyze that further, because that's already taken care of. Or you want to look at gender, maybe, so you need it to be a good represented. But anyway, this is a way to make sure that that you get a good representative population. And then we usually call these methods for probability sampling methods. What you are more likely to do, I say unfortunately, but again it has to do with practical limitations usually, is to do some kind of non-probability sampling. And this is then the family name of a number of methods you do to when you try to get a population, to get someone to answer your questions. Of course, the simplest form of that is just to ask everybody. Or you ask those who are at hand, to be more precise. That's what we call convenience sampling. We take whatever population we can get access to. We take whatever respondents that we can get access to. And then we try to analyze things as best as we can later, and to be very careful about analyzing biases and stuff like that, and also discuss it maybe in the paper later. So, for practical reasons, we tend to use convenience sampling, but it's very different based on convenience sampling to get representative populations. It can be done more sophisticated. And now and then it is also needed to do that. And an example of something like that is what we call here snowball sampling, which is quite a useful method for a lot of questions that we have. And that some of you might have. I've mentioned this. I mentioned gaming, for instance. And if we're focusing on something we can call excessive gaming, people who are addicted to games and spend too much time, if we use some kind of a judgment of what too much time is on games, let's say we are interested in people. In motivators for people that plays World of Warcraft more than 40 hours a week or something like that. Well, it's unlikely that you will get access to a lot of respondents, and it's not worth it probably doing a general request among the whole population. See. A general poll towards all Norwegians or something like that is not likely to get many of these excessive gamers to respond. So when you do snowball sampling, you find one. Maybe you find a friend or a friend of a friend or something like that. And then you start asking his network or her network again about other gamers or name lists and stuff like that. And that's typically called a snowball sample method. You won't get a representative sample, but you will probably get a representative sample of those of the very narrow population you're interested in, which is a very well, or maybe a homogeneous as well population. It's 98% boys in the age span 17 to 31 or something like that. So it can be a good method. Another thing to be aware of when you do questionnaires is that people are quite good at analyzing or good at understanding the reasons behind questions. They try to interpret in what context the questionnaire is used. It may be conscious, it can be unconscious as well. And you tend to get responses according to that in some way. It tends to influence the way you answer things. If your employer asks you how many weeks or many days a week or how many, how many extra hours a day or something like that you spend working, well, you tend to give a higher answer than the truth. Curiously enough, if you ask people about their age, you tend to get a lower number than the actual age. There is a way around that, and that is to answer, and that's maybe something we can take into strategies for asking answers. There are ways of asking questions that makes it more difficult for responders to understand the reason behind the question or to do this kind of wrong responses, and that is to make the question a bit less obvious. So if you ask people the year of birth, for instance, they give the right response. Of course, it's not necessarily it sounds funny that people do this, but it's not necessarily a conscious thing either. It can have to do with, well, the older you get, the less focused you are on this. And the last time I remember I had a birthday, I was 45 or something. That's good. So there may be some systematic things there, but you always know your year of birth. So people always answer that correctly. There are, of course, other. When people discover what you're asking for, it may lead to problems when you're going to judge the validity and trying to generalize the answers, because you get some systematic biases towards one type of answers. The most typical effect is that the respondents wants to be kind to you in some way. The people are polite, so they tend to be less critical when they know that you are for instance, if you represent a company that has launched the software, your friends are more likely to be friendly towards you than the normal population. And there is a selection bias towards one of the sides here. Question? I don't know. absolutely. Who answers those questions? And it is an issue when you ask sensitive questions, for instance, to let's say young adults, or youths that are legally needs to be be allowed to answer questions from their parents, if there are sensitive questions, for instance. And the responses is likely to be very affected by this. Just the fact that they know that their parents have been asked about their permission to give answers here. If you ask people about sexual debut age and stuff like that, it's really touchy stuff. But of kids is even more, but that may be something else, and that has to do with the competence of their answers. Are they really competent to give these answers? And that is another thing that I think I have something on it on the slide here. Know your audience, because if you ask questions that your audience isn't capable, or not necessarily capable of, but in general not competent of understanding, well, you're likely to get very random answers to the questions. Usually we tend to call this the bias that we get here. We have a technical name of that as well, and it's usually called demand characteristics. People are good at this. They are identifying what we're after in a questionnaire. Some answers are even very sensitive to the type of instructions that you give. It may go for questionnaires, but it especially goes for experiments. For instance, if I do an experiment in an eye tracker, we know that these types of studies, we're looking at gaze behaviors. The gaze behavior will be highly affected by the by slight variations in the in the instructions that you give. If you're asking people to look at the most important thing in this picture, they will do something else than if you just have a free view situation, and they will do something else than if you are asking them to look for the most important person in the picture or something like that. So the people are good at discovering these things, and the way to deal with it is, of course, to try to hide it in some way, or be clever when you ask the question, so that you actually get a more correct response. False information, blind experiments, we'll get back to it when we get to experiments. Yeah. I think we'll actually skip some of these things now. Just to break things up a little bit, let's do a little video here. We were talking about the inadequacies of humans as observers, and this is something you may have seen before. Those of you who haven't, let's just try this one. I think it can be done in full screen, because this is really a quite simple task that you're going to do here now. And for those of you who have tried it before, you can keep quiet. It's a pretty simple task here. And your task is to... You're going to see two teams that passes base... basketballs. It's quite a blurry situation, right? And during a minute or so, they're going to pass the ball a number of times to each other within the team. There are two teams, a black team and a white team. And your task is to count the number of times the white team passes the ball to each other. So it's a pretty straightforward thing. Should be easy. Try it. Hmm? 15, 16? I'm not sure. We'll get to it. Did you see the gorilla? Did everyone see the gorilla? Who didn't? Some didn't. It was 15, so you were right. But if we look back here, something strange happened in the middle there. It wasn't just a discrete thing. A man in a gorilla costume came in there and made a lot of noise and went out. So a lot of you have seen similar things, I guess, and that's why you see it. And you knew that I was going to trick you with something, and you maybe even saw the header there. But the thing is, this is how we are as observers. We tend to see what we are, let's say, focused on seeing. That's what we actually discover in a situation. When it comes to how I had a few slides here that had to do with how you formulate questions and stuff like that in questionnaires. The book that you have is quite good in this. It gives you quite detailed recommendations for what to do. What I thought I could spend a little time on was what you can do to maximize your response rates. Because this is a very challenging issue when it comes to doing surveys. Timing. When you're students, you tend to do some last-minute things near the point where you are going to deliver something. And that tends to come in line with what you ask other students, and they may be occupied with the same stuff as you are at the same period. So trying to avoid, let's say, asking questions at any point of time where people are very occupied is probably not a very good idea. Invite people in a polite, good way. When you are inviting people to take part in a questionnaire, if you are, for instance, giving them a mail with a link to a questionnaire, which is a typical way to do it, be polite. Don't have a lot of typing errors. Don't try to say that it is you have to answer this question because I'm desperate or something like that. People like to be given a good impression of you. And that will actually, it seems quite obvious, but it has quite a huge impact on response rates. It will be much better, and it will be even better if you can motivate respondents by saying something about the importance of the stuff you do, and that it's not only important for yourself and your master thesis, but it's really important for them as well, or the knowledge that we get out of this. That will also really improve the response rates that you get. And of course it is, you can be persistent and nag people who don't give you responses right away. You can resend mails and ask them to, or politely remind them that couldn't you please answer this? You may have forgotten something here. So it's fair to do that a couple of times, but usually not more than two. It's impolite to do it a lot of times, and it's usually not very productive either. So the responses you won't get after the first reminder, well, you're probably not going to get them anyway, but two is okay. It's considered okay. Not more. But it's hard. Don't be disappointed if you don't get more than a 10% response rate, because 10% when you do general invitations is quite good. I'll just finish with some very quick things about another way to do to find something out, and this is what we call experimental methods and experimental designs. There are a nearly a more or less unlimited list of different experimental designs that can be applied to investigate some phenomena. So this isn't a complete list, and I don't intend that you should learn a list like this. The point with experimental designs is, of course, to reduce the chance of the error here in this equation. You try to eliminate errors by controlling for them via experimental conditions. That is the whole point with experimentation. And in its simplest form, but it's not a very good form, you can, let's just see if we can get this out. In its simplest form, you observe something. So you have the status of some phenomena that you're going to observe, and then you do some kind of a manipulation. You try something out. Let's use teaching in this case I teach as normal or something like that, and then I introduce a new teaching method, and then I see the scores after this has taken place or something like that. Or maybe the easiest example is to use the most standard one, what a doctor would do. He gives out medicines. So in this case, you look at the phenomena first, and then you give the pill, and then you see if things has improved afterwards. And of course, if it has improved, can you say it was because of the pill? No, you can't. Because this is too simplified to actually take control of some of the important factors. Maybe the respondents would have become better anyway, even without the pill. So maybe this, and you don't control for stuff like that in a simple experiment. So what we tend to do then is that we use a control group, and that's a straightforward thing. By applying the same procedures for both the experimental group and the control group, we make sure that that it's the effect of the pill that is the cause of the difference between these two groups, and the difference from here to here. So in an ideal world here, then these should be the same for the control group, while these should have improved or something like that. So that's one of the reasons we use control groups. In medicine, you use you apply another level of control here as well, and that is that you're looking at the effect of the treatment itself. So the knowledge about treatment itself. So what you do is that you give another pill that doesn't work, and that's the placebo pill. So even though you can see an effect in this group, well, you can isolate that has to do with this pill and not the fact that you knew you were getting a pill. That is to give the experimental group and the control group very comparable conditions. And this may be very important for a lot of cases, because the knowledge of being measured may be important. The fact that people are telling you that we are doing something to see whether you will become more productive or something like that will probably make you more productive. And that is why you tend to control things this way. And to be make this even more complicated, what they tend to do when they do this in a medical environment or as the gold standard for testing out medicine, they also do it blindly, so that the people who administer the pill doesn't know which ones are part of the control group or the experimental group, because they may also behave differently towards the two different groups. And the final level of control that we do in a very, in this kind of a gold standard straightforward experiment, is that we also make it random who is part of the control group and who is part of the experimental group. So it's random whether you get into the experimental group or the control group, and by doing that you are doing what we call a true experimental design. You're designing a true experiment. If there isn't randomization involved, you tend to call it a quasi-experiment. So it may still be very good, but the fact that we don't apply randomization makes it somewhat more dubious, or makes it more difficult to handle. There are other more complicated designs. This is called the Salomon four-group design, which is quite similar to a normal control group design, in the way that if you compare the two first groups, there is a random assignment to group here. That's what this R stands for. Then you do an observation, what we tend to call a baseline. And of course, one of the groups get the real treatment, but we do one more thing here, and that is that for two of these groups, one of the groups get only the treatment, and one of them get only the final observation. And by that, we take out, for instance, the effect of history, or the effect that being observed the first time may affect the result on the second observation. So we take control of the situation. That's what we do in these kinds of studies. Another category of designs is what we call time serial designs. Can also be done on single subjects, where we establish a better baseline before we do a change. And by doing that, we reduce the need for control groups. So if you have fewer persons, maybe this is a good strategy, that we take more observations of those we have, and then any change here, any change occurring after here, either in trend or in level or something like that, can be interpreted as the result of this of the treatment that we implemented. I used the word treatment, but treatment could be anything. It's any experimental condition, any change in the situation that we apply. It can be any level, for instance, of the independent variable. We have more complex procedures, what we call factorial designs. Let's say if I'm going to compare variables that are have several levels, where both variables have several levels. The example here could be, let's say the example here is teaching. I have set two methods of teaching. And I have two different types of groups in my class. There are some off-campus students and some campus students. And maybe the different methods that I choose here in the teaching have different effects on these two groups. And this is what I can control for in this type of factorial balance design. So I have a number of stuff to do there. I'll get back to some of this in my next lecture. Next week you will have a lecture by the library, where you also will get a new assignment, a new short essay to write. But the week after, I'm going to talk a bit more about experimental control and stuff like that. And I'm going to talk a little bit about ethics in research. But what we'll also do then is to start up the project that we're going to do. And just to give you some idea about the timeline there, you may start thinking about this right away, because what we're going to do in 2 weeks' time is that I will come back here with some lists, and you will organize yourself into groups there. And each group consisting of somewhere between 3 and 6 persons should then plan to do an experiment or gather some data. It may be on a relevant topic, it may be a highly irrelevant topic, if you like to do that. So if you have some ideas about